From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me, as always, from parts various, are my co-hosts, Roger Mitchell and Giles Morgan. Gentlemen, where are you, Rog? Are you in the lake, on the lake, around the lake?
Yeah, I'm just always here, Grant. It's you has to... I'm in Como. I've had a nice Sunday lunch and probably a little bit too much wine, so you two can carry me. And I know you'll say you always do.
Oh, not again.
I know. There we go. I'm in Como. I don't know where the captain is. I know he's been buzzing around this weekend.
I've been whizzing around the UK. I've been in Wales speaking at a Welsh farmers agricultural show, and I kid you not, absolutely brilliant, talking about my life and sport. And I've been in Cambridge today with my family. And tomorrow I fly to Dallas and to Dallas, Texas, and then Fort Worth, where I'm on Friday going to the rodeo in Fort Worth, which I'm more excited about than I can possibly tell you.
Wow.
It's that's fantastic. It's quite an experience. It is quite an experience, trust me. Do you have a hat and boots? You will need a hat and boots.
No, I'm going to buy them there. I'm throwing money at the problem. I'm just going to give it full biff and just come back like a cowboy. I'll be like Woody from Toy Story.
Many people would say you've been a cowboy for years, Giles, so I wouldn't worry too much about that. Anyway, we have a fantastic guest this week. Roger, why don't you tell people who is going to be joining us shortly?
Nathan Homer. Who currently works at Now Television, which is the digital arm of Sky, which is obviously now Comcast. His background is in sports marketing, having worked at Gillette and Barclays around football, the Olympics. He also went on the rights holder side with the European Tour and was a key person delivering the magnificent Ryder Cup in Paris. We've got a lot to talk about. The thing that I'm very interested in, obviously, is the whole thing about, you know, cannibalization around Now Television, and because I myself have switched to Now TV from Sky, and interesting to see what they're doing there, and he'll give us a great insight.
Roger, what I think is interesting about Nathan's experience, as you say, he's been on really three sides of the traditional sports industry pyramid, I guess, in terms of being rights holder, brand side, and broadcaster. So I think with all of this sort of digital innovation that we talk about and the speed of technology, I think his point of view will be fascinating of where things are going.
Well, let's stop the three of us pontificating and let's get the guest on, shall we? Let's hear what he has to say.
Hello, Nathan. Roger here.
Hey, Roger. How you doing?
Good to speak to you. Good to speak to you, and welcome to Are You Not Entertained?
Thank you, sir.
Let me introduce you to my partners in crime, Grant Williams, and obviously Captain Morgan.
Nathan, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for doing this.
Absolute pleasure. Hello, Captain Morgan. Your ship sounded very fruity the other day.
Oh, thank you, sir. It's good to speak to you on back on land, actually. I've been a bit seasick all week.
May have been the rum.
Well, anyway, to get a sponsor, I'll keep pushing the rum until one of the brands comes in.
Nathan, we're just going to, as is our want on this season of the podcast, go straight into something that gets the ball rolling. And I think there's nothing more topical this week than the 25 years anniversary of Eric Cantona at the Palace. And I wanted to link that and get your opinion on the Ben Stokes reaction down in South Africa to the abuse from the fan, and now we've heard the reaction of his employers, and I'd like you to give us your view as somebody who's seen it all as to whether Stokes did the right thing and whether his employers have reacted in the right way.
Yeah, so it was amazing, really, that the Cantona piece was 25 years to the day as the Stokes story was breaking. I mean, amazing coincidence. I mean, I think Stoke is a classic example for me where, you know, do we want people that are being looked at by, you know, huge numbers of young people as heroes to be role models? Well, yeah, of course you do. But I think there's a reality of, you know, the real world needing to come into that. And, you know, this, I call it the white line syndrome. You know, the idea that, you know, often perfectly rational people go somewhere and because of the white line on a piece of grass, they think they can shout and abuse sports people in a way that they would never, ever dream of doing in the streets to anybody else. I think is actually something that, you know, is the bigger issue that needs tackling. And personally, I think, you know, someone like Stokes, I think it's pretty refreshing that people get a real inside view of, you know, what happens in the real world. You know, if someone said that to, he might be a bad example, if someone said that to him in the real world, you know, I suspect he'd react very similarly, as would most of us. And I think this sort of saccharine, you know, role, perfect role models, almost the Disney heroes, it's not real. And, you know, the way people deal with adversity, the way they deal with other people, the way they interact, I think it's more interesting when it's how life is.
Well, the other thing I would say, personally, yeah, Nathan, what's interesting, what I thought about it too, is that Stokes knew he'd reacted the way he had, and he apologised instantly, and therefore, in a sense, it's done. You know, you're right, spectators can behave appallingly, and there's that. But also, it's not as if he didn't apologise, but he was very riled, and that's the real world. I think it's a classic piece of, it's a great media story, but I hope this one goes away. He's the character that Ben Stokes is becoming, I think, is a strong one for English sport.
Yeah, and it's an interesting observation that in 25 years since Cantona reacted in the heat of the moment as he did, you know, have things got any better for, you know, these wonderful athletes when they're plying their trade in, you know, a really hard situation? I'd say not. I'd say it's got worse. And I think some of the employers and organisations that come out and castigate, you know, their own people should possibly be looking a bit more in the mirror at what are they doing to make sure arguably a place of work is an acceptable place of work.
You know, so for me, Nathan, you know, we've seen this kind of pick up, and the age of social media now seems to be something that the fans kind of, you can probably bet at some point some film of this is going to come out on social media of the fan or someone around him filming this whole thing, you know, and the whole idea that you can rile these players up. We saw this recently, obviously in the President's Cup, and I would definitely want to talk to you about the sort of fan abuse in the Ryder Cup, because that's something that you have a lot of experience with. But you know, it seems to be that the attempts to provoke a reaction from sports stars is just getting bigger and stronger and nastier, and they're being held to ever kind of more stringent standards, which seems to me to be remarkably unfair.
Yeah, I think it's a total, totally unfair when you look at it the two ways. It feels like the athletes are under more scrutiny than they've ever been, and as you say, from everybody they ever bump into with a phone, the camera phone. And yet, you know, everybody else is almost in a situation where they're provoking them more and more, whether it's because they feel they can or they're trying to get their own 5 minutes of fame. And I think that balance is extremely challenging to walk. And I think, you know, the restraint actually they show 99% of the time is more laudable than the 1% where they do let something snap, say something. And I think, you know, Charles is 100% right. The fact that, you know, he did it, and what did he do? He apologised immediately, the same as I'm sure we've all done occasionally when we're out with friends or, you know, in a situation, and it's for shake hands and off you go. But well, it's, you know, that's just not what's allowed to happen.
It's interesting to me. I think we live in an age where the apology is unaccepted by, certainly by media and by the sort of censorious nature of the mass, which is people can apologise and it doesn't mean a thing because the story becomes bigger. And for me, it's old school. It's the old school, which is someone does something wrong, put your hand up, say sorry, move on. I think he did that. And on this occasion, the media got away with it. And I think maybe the ECB had to do something, but I hope this one is closed and we move on. And I have a sense it might be.
Giles, Nathan, I am, as somebody who is very, very even-tempered and never says a word out of place, I'd like to offer another another side of this, which is not one that I agree with, because I love my sports heroes the way Ben Stokes reacted, I have to admit. But people will say that this guy's got a previous, that he is a bit of a lout, that he has got anger management issues. You, as somebody who has been involved in sponsorship, if you had been around this guy with whatever brand it was, what kind of conversations would you be having internally at brand level around your involvement with this personality?
Yeah, I think that is a really interesting one in terms of who's the brand and who are they associating with and why. And I think, you know, certainly when I was at P&G, we were a classically risk-averse company. I think we'd have been straight into, you know, can we be associated with this guy? You know, how do we distance ourselves? Should we even be, you know, considering, you know, finishing his contract? It was a very risk-averse company. Whereas there's other brands that I think that real side of athletes, particularly young athletes living the life, you know, most 20-odd-year-olds lead, is actually very attractive to some of them. And yeah, when you look at some of the work they do and some of the stuff they get, you know, their brand ambassadors to do, that they're showing that much harder, grimier, real side of life. And so I think, you know, there's probably more brands today would be willing to say, he's the kind of guy that could tell our story, than in the past, where I think the risk averse piece was probably the 95%, whereas I think there's a few more now going, you know, that guy or that woman's got some interesting stuff for us to get into with them.
I agree with you, Nathan. I think there's going to be a shift change as more and more brands realise that the narrative of association, sponsorship, call it what you like, is that you've got to speak the language of the fan and of the association. And to take a kind of blue ribbon, slightly supercilious view, which is what traditional brands used to do and be very risk averse, it either means that you're not connecting with the audience at all, or it means you're permanently in terror of human beings failing. And I, you know, Nike have always led the way in terms of saying that they've always been gritty. But I think as you see more and more brands connecting with younger generations, is that they're going to, if not condone, they're certainly going to tolerate a lot more that kind of behavior. And I think that's good, because otherwise you're not in the narrative of the association.
But it's the fan piece. Yeah, at the end of the day, if 99% of your audience talk in a way, behave in a way, act in a way that you're going to somehow pretend an athlete from the same background with the same culture and the same, you know, values doesn't behave like that anymore, it's false, and it won't appeal to them and it won't work. And I think, as you say, I think there'll be a lot more tolerance of the reality of who people are, the lives they're from. And yeah, those people will have to adapt to some extent given, you know, the spotlight that they're now in. But I think there'll certainly be more businesses and more brands willing to, you know, be part of telling their real story versus, I'd call it, as I say, the Disney version.
Nathan, can I bring it back to the Ryder Cup? Perhaps Roger's obviously given the audience a little sense of your career, but perhaps you could just talk a little bit about your role at the Ryder Cup for some perspective. And I'd love to talk about the way that this particular situation we're discussing has kind of fermented at the Ryder Cup, because it's such a genteel sport. I guess it's more shocking when you start to get the kind of abuse we saw at the Ryder Cup. But perhaps just for a little bit of background, just talk about your role with the European Tour.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was the Chief Commercial and Marketing Officer, and, you know, whilst that was driving, obviously, a lot of the revenue parts of the business, I did also run the operations side. So sort of the tournaments we ran as a tour, you know, part of my team were the championship directors and the team putting them on, many of whom Giles will definitely have met over the years. And the Ryder Cup, you know, whilst it was primarily run by, you know, the outstanding Edward Kitson on an overall level, you know, a lot of the aspects to do with the fans, like the ticketing and the entrancing and the hospitality, you know, all fell very much to me. And, you know, I was on that classic thing at big events where you're working from 4 a.m. to 1 a.m. for several weeks. It's not particularly glamorous, but the adrenaline's incredible. And when they go well, it's a quite unbelievable experience. And as you say, I mean, linked to what you've just sort of alluded to, I was right down on the first tee. I was right down walking with some of the players at times between greens and tees, down fairways, and in a few fairly sticky situations where, you know, the players got in places they probably shouldn't have been, either in between matches as they were trying to get from one place to the other when the crowds were just, you know, huge and blocking the way, or, you know, as they were going to find their ball when they'd gone a bit offline. And it was interesting, you know, being able to be amongst that. Again, it's an interesting one of the reality is 99% of it was outstanding banter and support. And whilst it was raucous and loud, it was respectful. There was no noise when people were hitting. There was no inappropriate language or barracking. But, you know, the reality there is the 1% is the bit that gets suddenly seen, the video that the fan next to him took is replayed a million times within the hour. So you do get a slightly imbalanced point of view, I think, today, because everything is focused in on that. It's small minority versus why is it such an unbelievable experience generally? Because it's raucous, it's loud, it's fun, but it's still done in a, I'd say, the right way.
Yeah, it's been fascinating to watch it kind of develop. I mean, obviously Europe weren't really in the competition for such a long time until 85. And then as the competitions got tighter, so the raucousness has picked up. But you know, the last couple we've seen...
Patrick Reed's a good example. Yeah. I mean, I deliberately walked around with a few people who we were hosting in one of the practice rounds and one of the, I think, the first day. And he was fantastic with the crowd. I mean, he was orchestrating it. He was playing up to it. The crowd were absolutely loving the fact he was getting into it. You know, he wasn't being the anodyne, boring sportsman just going on the tee, pulling his cap down and ignoring it. You know, he absolutely joined in with it and was fantastic. And I think, you know, if you asked, again, 99% of the European crowd there, they'd say he went up in their estimation. They thought he's a brilliant part of the event. You've just got the few idiots who think it's clever to, you know, be that person.
But also, Nathan, from your point of view at your time at the European Tour, surely I would imagine that when you saw people like Reed or other players who were really getting the fan going and getting the crowds going as they did, that's just manna from heaven from you with the role you had, which is golf has a propensity on television to be very, very dull. And I say that as someone who has some involvement in a previous life. And yet it can be unbelievably exciting and binary, and Ryder Cup is obviously the greatest encapsulation of it. But when you've got characters like Seve is obviously the one that everyone remembers, but that's actually the grist to the mill that makes the whole telecast far more interesting.
Exactly. I mean, he's exactly the kind of person you want. And, you know, and the, as you say, the ones that just walk on and they're just sort of trying to blanket out, there's no reaction, there's no engagement. You know, you kind of know that's not going to help you and not help your sport in the long run. And, you know, they need to, the players are often slow in some sports, and they were slow in golf to embrace some of the changes that we needed. And Keith, you know, as the CEO with a very strong media background, you know, spent a huge amount of time trying to get the players to understand why we needed them to, you know, engage in a different way very often. And some did come on the journey, some naturally can do it, and others, you know, made a real effort and did push on. But yeah, exactly, the people that react like that, you instinctively home into. I suspect a lot of brands do, because they think they can get a lot more from them, and it's a bit of a virtuous circle.
How do you control that fine line between the likes of Ian Poulter on the first tee, amping the crowd up before that tee shot, and then, you know, get them all fired up, and then kind of expect them to know when to be quiet? You know, it's a really tricky line to walk.
Yeah, and we were very conscious in France that there could be a lot of fans there who, you know, the traditional etiquette of golf and being silent as people hit, you know, maybe totally alien to them. So they'd almost be innocently not doing it. And all you can really do is try and have the right number of marshals doing the right thing with all of the right information, you know, broadcast on the screens there and talked over the screens there, and, you know, made very clear to try and help, you know, particularly an audience that doesn't necessarily know the sport super well, you know, where those moments to be, you know, loud and noisy are, and and where those moments are, so they sort of they do get that understanding of the whole sport. And actually, one of the things in golf I used to love at the Ryder Cup was that that piece where, you know, 8,000 people in a stand are being going crackers for 10 minutes, and then you literally can hear a pin drop. And then the second the club hits the ball, it's back on again. I mean, it's a remarkable, it's a bit like, you know, the hush, the occasional hush you get before a really big penalty. And then depending on the result, you know, the stadium either goes crackers one way or the other. I think that up and down in pure energy is something actually to be encouraged, and you want to try and manufacture where you can.
Nathan, talking about all of that and those moments of up and down, all of that, certainly for the television viewer, is dictated by a wonderful commentator. And we are going to have on the captain's table out on Monday, Mark Pugash, who has done it so well for football in such a way. And, you know, we've seen it in golf as well with guys like Steve Ryder, obviously Peter Allis. What is your view about, you know, the people we've had, their role in taking golf to where it's got to and where it needs to go? And I would be really interested, now that you're on the broadcasting side, that you tell us what the role of the commentator is.
Yeah, well, I think it's more than just the commentator as well. I think, you know, when I was at the tour and, you know, we took ownership of European Tour Productions, one of the biggest efforts we made was on the whole, say, telecast, but actually the whole, everything we did in it, all forms of video and film, but particularly the TV coverage, of what were we putting in that would make this experience, you know, far more interesting? Because the reality is, in all sports, you know, the actual amazing action is a bit limited. And, you know, what can you do so that when people are watching the all of the other time it's on, that they're getting the best possible experience? And I think, you know, the commentators specifically, it was making sure they were brilliantly prepped. So it was making sure that anything that was going on in the background of the sport, of the players, of the places we were, so, you know, the cultures, the countries, you'd given them the best. You know, these guys are often just flying in. You know, they've not had a huge amount of time to even get over the jet lag. You know, we started to work incredibly hard on giving them prep. So, yeah, they do their own, but giving them prep to give them a much broader expanse to talk around whilst, you know, they were on air. And producing, you know, montages and footage and excerpts that could come into the broadcast that linked to that, so that you were just giving a much stronger flavour than, I'd call it, the classical shot by shot by shot by shot. And the difference, I think, you saw probably over the last 5 or 6 years is the emergence of people that can do that, and they can paint, you know, a broader picture beyond purely the sport itself. And for most fans, that adds a much higher level of interest than, you know, it's been done for years. You know, I mean, Test Match Special is the obvious example of that, where the cricket would go off for hours and you'd still listen to it, which seems crazy, but it was often the best part of it. So it's not new, but I don't think enough sports have put enough time and effort into enabling the commentators to be able to do that. Versus you've just been lucky in having commentators that were incredibly talented and prepped super professionally and could do it on the sport. I think now you need to do it around the sport in a much bigger way.
And this whole notion of narrative, of bringing the telecast, the whole media production to life. And of course, that requires great commentary, great production, and also the role of the players. And given this is all rolled up in the European Tour, did you get frustrated by moments? You alluded to earlier that a lot of it was my experience that a lot of the players didn't perhaps understand their role as being performers. And I mean, of course, they've got to be performers first in terms of performance, but there's also a sense where they've got to play their role in order to make the package more exciting. Did you feel, if you could give a percentage, what number of players got it versus those who didn't? And now you've left, it doesn't matter what you say, I presume.
As I say, that by far the biggest difference was explaining to them really well why it mattered. And as I say, Keith Pelly, the CEO, spent a huge amount of time talking to the very top players and all the way through the rank and file. So then it wasn't just, hey, can you come and do this for us? they actually understood why it all mattered, why it all came together, and actually trying to do things that you've built a good story of why wouldn't you want to do this. And something like the Hero Challenge that we started doing on Tuesday nights, you know, 1 hour made for TV special, but kind of target golf with simple scoring, a lot of banter, the players are mic'd up, different types of presenters from kind of the TV world, not really golf commentators. And the players, you sort of think, this is a bit gimmicky, do I want to get involved? Within the first two, they suddenly realized this was their way to show their personality. The ones who liked it, they could show their personality off, they could be relaxed, it didn't really matter. And guess what? There was good opportunities that new brands, new audiences, new people were tuning into this. And, you know, we showed it was live on the usual broadcast channels, but we partnered with Twitter and they basically ran it as a sort of set of 20 or 30 1-2 minute videos out through Twitter. And we got kind of 70% of the audience who engaged with it had never interacted with golf on Twitter before.
There you go.
The story to some of the players became, this is how you, you know, guys, this is how you build your own audiences, you know, because you know that's important. You're kind of doing that, but this is the way you do it. You know, we can help you do it. And it becomes a, you know, anytime you can create a win-win story and you help people understand why you're asking them to do more extra things, there's a better chance of doing it. So I think you've got to have a smart plan and you've got to be prepared to put the time and effort into explaining to the athletes why you want them to be part of it, not just, can you come and do another little silly video on social media?
So, Nathan, why do you think, at least from my point of view, when you look at the Golf Channel now, you seem to see the golfers much more engaged and much more appreciative of what you've just said there? What has happened there to kind of like take them in a direction where they're much more comfortable to speak between shots and everything like that? How do you look at that as a broadcaster now?
I think that's one of the innovations that we sort of said has got to come. You know, we've just got to try it. And it was, in the end, some things you do just have to mandate. And guess what? As soon as we started to do it, that fear of what the downside just totally vanished. Because, of course, we started with players that were naturally comfortable doing it. So someone like a Lee Westwood, he's very relaxed when he's playing. You know, he's very good at just casually chatting. He gives good insights. So we picked some players we kind of knew it would work with. And then when the other players sort of saw them doing it and it was, you know, seemingly very easy, very comfortable, they became more comfortable. And, you know, we just basically expanded it. That's a good example of when you just expand it slowly in a way that keeps people comfortable. And if you can do that, it's very fast becomes accepted. And everyone within a year thinks it's just something that, you know, that's part of the week-to-week daily life.
Nathan, what did you think of the Tiger Woods Phil Mickelson made for TV thing they showed last year? I think it was. It may have even been 18 months ago. You know, we talked about it on the show at the time. I watched it and I was incredibly disappointed in it. I thought it was actually pretty poor. But as a broadcaster, what did you take away from that? Is that the future? Was that sort of an okay first step into that kind of arena?
Yeah, I think, well, two sides to that. One, I mean, I think this idea of the set piece sports event is a huge trend that fits into, you know, the shifting world of how audiences consume things and what they want. So setting up things that are rooted in real simplicity, and they're one-off moments, you know, they don't ladder up to a World Cup or a league, or, you know, they're just one-off. And sports itself, by the way, is in sort of inverted... the Logan Paul KSI fight, you know, the Ineos 159, and just the Tiger Phil one would be another one. It's a manufactured idea, it's a concept, and I think you will see more and more and more of that. I think they've got a huge role to play. I think if I was a sports organisation now, I'd be looking for what are our versions of them, because if we can find a few, you can drive some serious revenue and audiences into them. But you've got to have a good concept and you've got to execute them well. And I think that one failed on both. You know, the concept was 15, 20 years too late.
Yeah.
And it was pretty badly produced.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There just wasn't that fun and spark and entertainment. It just went on for far too long. there's only so much banter you can have over that amount of time between two people. You know, concept was a bit late, not quite right, pretty badly produced, therefore didn't work.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
Nathan, are you a bull or a bear about the sports industry in general? I mean, clearly every conference, everybody's talking about tech, everyone's talking about disruption, everybody's talking about consumer habits, everybody's saying the same thing. But if you're sitting as a rights holder right now, where you've got a differing demographic change, obviously Gen Z is doing different things, consuming in different ways. Are you a bull or a bear about the sports industry in the next 20 years? Are you worried about it, or do you think there's a golden age?
I actually think it's a golden age. It'll be a golden age. It's a bit like any other business. It'll be a golden age for those that take advantage of it and clean up. But there will undoubtedly be those that try and stay as they've always been, and they'll just get swallowed by it, and there'll be some pretty precarious situations where some sports that have been around for an awful long time, I genuinely think, will go bankrupt or be saved from it at the last minute by someone else.
Well, it happened to jousting, so it can happen, right? And I say that flippantly, but it's true, is if you stand still, and I think it's something that Roger and I talk about a lot, is I think you're exactly right, is those that stand still, those that say, well, the TV model is the same TV model and it's always worked for us, let alone understanding the detail and the makeup of the fan, if you don't understand that now, you are likely to wither and perish.
The difference for me is, are you running a sports organisation or a business? If you're running a sports organisation, you're effectively organising, you know, the sport to be played between people and teams to win whatever the prize is. If you're a business, you still have to do that because that is your raison d'etre. But what you should actually be doing is building everything around that and even guiding what that looks like. Built on how are we going to maximize our return from this? And I give you a good, you know, this is for me, do you understand your audience as customers versus fans? I think a lot of sports organizations still think of people as purely as fans, and they think of the monetization therefore in the sort of classic model. And the people that I think will do well are the people that, you know, they've got a really strong insight into what will drive audiences to come into something. And that one we've just talked. Can you set up a fantastic set piece event that is simple to understand, highly appealing, and you know, has a strong concept, and then you deliver it brilliantly and people come in and come out?
Isn't that the point of, therefore, the processing and understanding the fan is, you're right, you've got to view them and treat them as customers from a monetization point of view. But the bit before is you've got to know who they are, which is means you've got to have a real in-depth understanding of what moves a fan and why a fan is what it is. Otherwise, if you treat them just as a commodity unit of currency, you won't understand the ebb and flow. But at the same time, you're quite right, if you then don't commercialize that, you're not going to make the money. So there's a two-step process to this, rather than just I think there's an old expression I was taught, is that assumption is the mother of all fuck-ups. And I think there's a truth to that. There's too many sports organizations who just assume they know the fan.
Yeah, absolutely. They don't, you know, you're back to the old, you do ask people, what data do you have? And I think the question you're asking them is, how many email addresses do you have? You know, that's not what people mean by what data do you have on your audiences. You know, if you're any other type of business, you'd scratch your head at, you know, do I have the email address? That's not what you mean. And I think too many of them, like you said, they jump to the end point and you say, well, why do you want OTT? Why do you want to use Twitter? Why do you want to do it? They kind of are the dog that barks at every passing car. You know, it's there. Everyone's talking about it. Right, what's our strategy for that? Versus stepping back and saying, look, what are we actually trying to achieve? What do we know about our current and potential audience that we think we can get to? And therefore, what would we build and how would we, you know, convey it to them to build that model around it? And, you know, one of the masters of this, you know, people say, who does it well? And I always, Barry Hearn is your man. Yeah. He is the guy who has rooted everything he's ever done. And what do I know about this audience that I think I can make some money out of? Right, I now know what I need to know. I've now worked out what I need to build to attract them, and then I'm going to deliver it brilliantly. And he's done it again and again and again for, well, take your pick, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. And he's done it again and again, doing things that everyone else scoffed a bit at and said, and how are you going to do it in that, Barry? And, you know, boxing is a good example, I think, currently, where, you know, if you want to, who do I think is going to do well in the next 10 years? I think boxing has got the potential to do unbelievably well. I think 5 years ago, it was really struggling, and you'd have been looking, saying, you know, has boxing really had its day? I think now, you know, a few smart people on both sides of the Atlantic have realised that this sort of set piece, big focal moments around them, this is there's a game time versus rest of the time. You can create some great other set piece moments in the build up and all through, during, and around the fights. And you can deliver them in using a great mixture of the new tools that are available. And they're getting great returns from doing that and bringing new audiences back into a sport that, as I say, 5 years ago, I'm not sure people thought those audiences would come back there.
Yeah, Nathan, this is something we've spoken about a lot on this podcast, and Roger and I have gone back and forward about it. And I'm really interested to hear, as someone involved in the business side of the game, how you think about this very fine line, because over time, sport has always evolved, and it's kind of taken the fans along with it. But the evolution has been really kind of incremental. They would add a new cup competition, but it would be the same kind of format, and they really built everything around that fan base that's been there forever. Now technology has enabled the kind of leaps that give you really almost an option to say, well, okay, do we take the quantum leap that technology allows and completely reinvent sport and reinvent it primarily with the future fan in mind? And we may lose the old fan, but they're not going to evolve as fast as the technology. So we may have to make a break here, because it feels like we're at a moment like that to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think the organizations that will really win are the ones that do both. So, you know, how do you keep the magic in what you currently have? And there's an awful lot of magic, but build for the future. So, you know, it's a bit like a classic business. You can't take your eye off your core that delivers your profit today whilst you build, you know, the products and the brands of the future. And I think you look at someone like the NBA, has their core product changed a lot in the last 10, 15 years? I don't think it has, but they bolted some brilliant stuff around it that has enabled them to, you know, get to new audiences, whether in new territories or, you know, just the younger audience coming through that you could have said, oh, will these people come into basketball like their older brothers or parents did? I think, you know, they're someone that constantly, you know, is doing innovation around their corporate. And you're seeing the results of that. In golf, you know, we were trying that hard. We were saying, look, we've got some really powerful things that should need to stay as they are because they work well for us. But we need to build some things that are totally different, totally new. We need to try them. Some will work, some may not. Because, you know, we're not going to get people all the way to, you know, I'd call it the traditional end of the funnel in the way that we used to. So to get them into the sport, to get them interacting with our heroes and our stars, we're going to have to get them doing some different things. And, you know, some of that was some of the digital videos and films we did. You know, we made to get our stars into areas of the media we would never, ever get our golf content. And that started to, you know, build a bridge to some of our potential casual sports fans that we'd say, why can't we get these, you know, people involved in golf once a year, twice a year, three times a year, you know, actually following us online, because they go, these guys' videos are brilliant. They're kind of linked to golf, but they're not really golf videos. And again, it's that understanding, well, who are you trying to get after? What are you going to have to serve them to win? And why do you want them? Like, what are you going to do with them once you've got them? And how do you, to Giles' point before, how do you commercialize that and get money from it? I think there are too many where they're saying, oh, I know I've got to do something different. I know I've got to get this new audience. And if you say, well, what are you going to do with them once you've got them? There's sort of a bit of a pause and a scratch of the head.
Nathan, I want to come on to a little bit to this point that you're raising, which is this finding this balance of transition. We are obviously in a period of transition and not losing the older classic fans, the authentic fans, the ones that we all think we belong to. and then find these new audiences that we've talked about that live in a different way, live in different platforms and want to consume content in a different way. And indeed, you know, we've spent, you know, 2 years in this podcast trying to discuss finding this balance. But I'd like to ask you, you yourself are in the middle of this because Sky Television has been the bank for sport for the best part of 30 years. And now you're in charge of what I would call the younger brother of Sky Sports, which is Now Television, which many people would say is exactly what you've just described, but in the media sector. So, you know, so what I mean by that, I mean this. One could say that every subscriber to Now Television is cannibalizing Sky TV's cash cow model. I myself have switched to Now Television in Italy, and Sky, then, you know, for a month, 2 months, the churn people called me and said, "Well, why have you left us? Can we offer you something else? Would you like a discount?" And I just at the end said to them, "I left you because it's cheaper at Now TV and it's more flexible. I can switch on and off when I want." So explain to us and the listeners what the strategy is to try and find the balance within that organization you work for now.
Yeah, and it's funny actually when you look at business models, you know, they're very rarely unique to one business, one category or one business. And I think it's a classic portfolio play, yeah, that if you only have one product that does one thing, it's pretty unlikely it's going to appeal to everybody in a category. And I think, you know, 6-7 years ago when Sky were looking at the way the audience and the customer was likely to change, you know, they were really brave and they said, "We're going to get in and do this ourselves because someone else is going to do it," as obviously they are. And there's, you know, plenty of other people coming playing in the streaming world. And, you know, the simplistic, well, isn't it just your own Sky audience that's trading down, I think ignores the much, much bigger picture, which is there's a huge audience that just wouldn't buy a Sky product, you know, as their initial way into watching whatever they're watching, because it's just not, you know, how they build the products that they want. It's why they, you know, they want flexibility. They want exactly as you've just described, to dip in and out of things. And in some cases, they might not have maybe the income to afford it, you know, a long-term higher cost model, but with a lot of other benefits. But by, you know, a few years down the line, then this actually, I would like all of those other bits and I can afford them now. So the audience needs and desires are very different and the products deliver against those. And, you know, when you look at the overlap, it's probably significantly smaller than I think most people instinctively think, because by nature, you do reflect it a bit down to, hey, well, if I move from that to that, is that what the whole model is? And it's not really. I think it is that there's a lot of customers who want different things. And in a perfect world, you know, your company has a portfolio model that can deliver as much of that as possible, so you get as big a share of the pie as possible.
Nathan, how do you guys think about you brought up the cost factor there and, you know, incomes and stuff. There's been a lot of kind of talk in the last couple of years about the affordability of taking a family of four, for example, to an NBA game. It is unconscionably expensive. Do you guys, from the programming side, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, but do you see this as an opportunity in that people will probably cut back on the live events because they can pay more for a subscription at home and watch more sport on TV? Or do you feel there's a problem here in that if the clubs are forced through unaffordability to change their offering, that impacts upon the sort of broadcast product?
One of the shifts you're seeing, I think, in all pay TV broadcasters around the world is this: everything used to be built effectively around the live event, or, you know, replays of the live event. And actually, one of the shifts that's coming, I'd argue, it's coming from the digital world. You know, a lot of the new content that's fundamentally been made for people to view, you know, whenever they like, to engage them with their club or their organization or individual athletes. And that content is now finding its way into broadcast as well, because people, when they switch on, if they're not looking for the live event, they're still looking to be, are you entertained? Yeah, they want to be entertained by, you know, things that interest them in that area. And I think that's certainly something that, if you look, there's a big growth of, which is that the non-live, non-core sport content that is, you know, filling more and more time, both in the traditional broadcast, but also in the digital spaces. And, you know, Sky Sports is a great example where, you know, there's so much more to the offering that Sky Sports has now than it would have had, you know, 5-10 years ago. It lives in its digital spaces, not in its core channels through a box.
Well, and it's what was used to be called, and probably still is somewhere, shoulder content, which is that used to be the filler before the main event, is now the filler is often as big, if not bigger, than the main event. And you're seeing that with the Netflix and documentaries. You're seeing it through what Sky and others are doing. And it's bringing sport to life, which, of course, is so essential for those new audiences, because as we're all talking about it, but we're all old, is this is all about the next generation. And how on earth do you keep them engaged, and through what channel, when and how?
Yeah, and I think it's that there is a bit of a linear spectrum, and I talked to slightly on golf of, am I going to get someone to jump straight into watching 4 days of a golf tournament? No. So therefore, what do I have to do to start getting this person to engage with us, with our stars, with the game, with our tour? Then, and once I just start to get them in, then how do I develop that with the view that, you know, in a perfect world along the line, I get them right down to the end and they are an absolutely core avid fan. But actually, the reality is you've got to chunk up your potential audience, build the products that will appeal at each level, and work out your monetization model along the way. I think where a lot of sports are struggling and will fail is there's almost a, I'm doing all of the first bits to get them to that, the classic endpoint, and the classic endpoint's where I'll then make my money off them. And I think what you've got, the ones that succeed are building models. And I think, you know, at the tour, we were proud of that something like the Hero Challenge that we were doing fundamentally to get to a new audience and start getting them into our game and our world. We were still making profit on because we built it and we worked out what the model was to make money even in that bit.
And think, is that, you know, true, Nathan? Is that true? And I'm not being a hard-bitten journalist. I'm not. But I know that a lot of innovation happened with the European Tour. A lot of things like the Hero Challenge happened, and that's great. But did that change the audience? Did that make a difference? If I start looking at the data, seeing that more young people are watching European Tour golf than they were 5 years ago, is that proved, or is that work in progress?
Are they watching more four-day championship golf? A very small shift. Are they engaged with sport, with the tour, with our stars far more than they were? That absolutely is true. And we did have the insight and the data and the ability to use that, you know, to monetize and do some different things with some different brands. So that's what I mean. You know, for me, if you're modeling it, I'm going to get them all the way along the line to be kind of the classic fan of today. And it's only then you start to make money out of them. I think there's a strong risk you don't get them there and you burn a lot of money on the way. Whereas whilst you are going to have to do some investment, you know, as fast as you can, you want to build models that are driving in a new audience for, you know, whichever the reasons you might want. And you're able to monetize and have those kind of as standalone P&Ls that mean they're delivering for your business. You can choose to say, you know, break even's fine because there's a role, and as people move on, we make the money. But, you know, I think if it's all, this is our seed money that, you know, we know we'll lose on, I think there's a risk you're not hard enough on, are we doing this right? Has this got a long-term sustainable future and role for us as an organization?
Nathan, I'm going to push back a little bit on that. I normally am quite harsh on sports rights holders, but this time I'd like to defend them a little bit with a specific example of what you've just said. So let's take the English Football League, which has been one of the main properties on Sky Sports. I would argue, were one of the first to do exactly as you have suggested with what they called the iFollow product, which would have been this investment, toe in the water, whatever you want to call it. I would suggest to you, Nathan, that the chief executive and the marketing director lost their jobs because that didn't deliver on the subs number. So I don't think it's that easy to do what the textbook is saying these days. And the realpolitik is that people and sports want to stay safe and they want to have their cake and eat it. And this funnel is great in theory, but when you have to actually deliver it, it's very, very tough.
Yeah, I didn't say it was easy. So I think it is tough, and it requires, and it gets into a different area of debate. You know, will you get that from the same sports people that have run the sports organisations for a long time? That's not necessarily the case with the EFL, but I think, you know, to drive some of those ideas, to drive some of the insight and the understanding that you need before you even get to the ideation and concept stage and then execution, I think you need people that are going to look at it with a different lens, whilst understanding, you know, well, what's the bigger picture in this sport that we're getting towards. But it's tough and it's difficult, and people will, you know, fail. And, you know, at the tour, we failed plenty alongside the things that we talk about that's still going. But I don't know, maybe that's one where, you know, they put an awful lot of their eggs in one basket, and had it worked, it would have been easily, it would have all been great. But, you know, what did they have alongside that when that one didn't maybe quite work as they all hoped?
Yeah, no, I'm agreeing with you, Nathan. But the debate is this one, as you know. Let me phrase it in a slightly different way about business models, about whether you call it OTT or direct to consumer or whatever. Younger generations, it is absolutely not proven that they will put their hand in their pocket and put in pay subs. Because up until now, they're living off the subscriptions that their parents have got for Spotify and for Netflix and DAZN and things like that. So the subs model, I think, in terms of ability to pay by youngsters, is really far from proven. Secondly, any time you go down the advertising model in the digital world, you come across those two big gorillas that are taking 95% of the money, which are called Facebook and Google. So I honestly think it is very difficult for rights holders to do this transition in a controlled way, which nobody notices that we've moved from a B2B model to a B2C model, and everybody is still smiling and happy. I keep coming back to the fact that I think these next 5 years will dictate the next 25 for that exact reason. I think nobody knows the answer.
No, and, you know, as I said earlier, I'm pretty convinced there'll be some tough failures, and there'll be some tough failures amongst very big established sports that have been around a long time, because they won't be agile enough and move quickly enough. I think they will be, you know, everyone talks about it. The big events are getting bigger and they're sucking up even more of the focus and the money because everyone wants to be involved with them and around them. I think there'll be some really smart, proactive sports that, you know, maybe don't even exist at the moment or are literally just up and coming, that will do some brilliant stuff. They'll create some great concepts and content. They'll tap in brilliantly to an audience, and they'll emerge and people will say, wow, how did that happen? And, you know, UFC is the big, big example of that, I guess, over the last 15 years or whatever. But I think there'll be some classic...
For whom the bell tolls? Who's going to be... who's going down? I'm fascinated. I agree with you.
Yeah, Nathan,
I just think,
tell us who's going down.
Well, given you... I think you know one of my big passions is rugby league. It really worries me that someone like the Rugby League could be someone like that. You know,
wow.
Very traditional sport, still run by a very traditional, you know, bunch of people that have been around the same sport for a long time. There's the classic thing that I think a few sports have got, and golf's not exempt from this, which is, you know, they spend their time fighting internally instead of looking at the real enemy, which is outside. And you say, guys, if you guys have got to hold hands and you've got to build the strongest thing together as a sport, or, you know, there's a lot of other people out there fighting for the same money, the same people, the same piece. Yeah, I think the clubs will be fine at the passion at the local level for the individual clubs. Yeah, the clubs are going to survive. will the competition survive? Yes. Will it survive in the way it does today with the money it has today? That worries me as a genuine fan. You know, that's my sport. It's a sport I grew up. I watched Leeds. You know, some of my heroes were those guys back. You know, Gary Schofield, Ellery Hanley. It's a sport. It really worries me. You know, they're fighting internally when the world outside is tougher than it's ever been.
Nathan, I think I'm impressed that you answered the question. It's not an easy one, and I would sort of add fuel to that fire. I would argue that quite a number of the Olympic sports that have been protected by the IOC and protected by the Olympic movement for a long, long time are also in danger in terms of that, how they engage with the broader fan. And if it wasn't for the Olympic patronage, they'd find themselves in deep trouble. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. And, well, I'll give you another sport that is a good example of what they haven't done but could have done. So, you know, and I mean, Nick Goward's just picked up the reins, but, you know, UK Athletics for, you know, 10 years, I think if you'd have asked them, would have gone, you know, it's really tough to get people to come along running. You know, numbers are down at nearly all our clubs. It's really difficult. Here's what we're doing about it. You know, and then you say, well, these people at Park Run and Bubble Run and Colour Run and Tough Mudder don't seem to be having trouble getting people to come out and run and pay them for it. The Park Run being the exception to that, obviously. You know, there's a lot of good businesses out here, Human Race, you know, making very nice money getting people out running in huge numbers. You know, why didn't UK Athletics see that, do that, partner with them, use the stars that they had to coat it? You know, and it's not to have a real go at them. It's just to say that's a good example for me where in their industry, there was plenty of innovation that has been massively successful that they had almost nothing, certainly didn't start any of. And I have to believe a few of those people went and knocked on their door saying, hey, it'd be great if we could do this with the, you know, the governing body endorsement. Didn't happen for whatever reason. And that's just one. That would be a good example.
Don't you think it's fascinating? I don't know if you saw in the UK Sunday Times today, Mike Moritz, one of the some major investors, and probably Wales's richest man, has come in and supported Pro Triathlon. And I think that's a very interesting model. He's investing in a broadcast model. He knows it's a tech-rich, tech-savvy sport. And if someone like that is coming in there, as you say, compared to some of the other more traditional sports, the worm is turning, to use a two Ronnie's 70s sketch.
Yeah, I don't know if that's useful, but the how do you get people running question, I'm not sure UK Athletics ever stood back and did that with an open mind, looking at the audience and saying what would actually excite them to get out there. It's probably not turning up on a Tuesday night at 8 p.m. to run around the track with someone giving them sort of detailed running instructions. And I'm being pretty harsh on athletic clubs, many of whom do a great job, of course, and are booming. I mean, Fulham's a good example, you know, of one that a few of my mates go to. But at the bigger level, I don't think that work was done or those conversations were possibly ever had. I'll assume Nick Coward will be sending me a message shortly.
You know, Nathan, you said, how do you get people to get out and run? I think the simple answer to that is probably chase them. But look, we've had it's been a fascinating conversation. And as Giles and Roger said, fair play to you for answering those, because, you know, this is such an important conversation. And I mean, you know, we've seen this week that the starting to drop broadcasting of cycling, you know, which is when you look at the number of bikes you see on the road now, it is extraordinary to me that cycling is struggling. But a lot of these sports are under pressure, and it's going to be fascinating to watch how the sports themselves work with the broadcasters like yourself to try and figure out what the right way forward is, because there's so many different ways to go. But look, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for answering all the questions in such a straightforward, honest fashion. It's fascinating to have these discussions. And before you go, if you could just let people know how they can perhaps follow you on social media and stuff.
Well, thanks for the invite, guys. It's absolute pleasure. It's interesting conversation, interesting times. Luckily, we didn't get into me having to talk more about rugby league, but or Stuart Pearce, my all-time hero. But it was absolute pleasure to. He's an odd choice for a rugby league fan, but anyway, thanks for that, guys. And yeah, I'm on the usual channels. People can find me, but they'd be better off listening to you. It's a lot more fun than anything I do.
Well, Nathan, we'll have you back for a complete Stuart Pearce episode, because I think you've got plenty more fans of Pearcey on this podcast. But again, thanks so much for joining.
Yeah, we can do a Psychos and Football podcast. Absolutely. That's one I'm writing down as we speak.
Nathan, thanks very much. Very good to hear your voice, and we'll speak soon.
Nathan, you were wonderful. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Cheers, guys. Bye.
Right. Cheers.
Well, there we go. What a fascinating conversation.
And a brave one. Really, really good.
You know, but Roger, isn't that funny that it is brave, but isn't it sad that is brave, right? Just answering a straightforward question with a straightforward answer. It's such a shame that is actually brave these days. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you know what? It's one of the things I've been talking a lot about recently in my sort of day job, where the sports industry is very self-protective, because people like the entitlement of access of tickets, of being in the inner circle. And as a result of that sense of self-protection means people very often are scared to come over the parapet and say what they think, which is wrong, because clearly by people not challenging means you're not getting the evolution quick enough. And to hear Nathan, who's, as we said at the top of the show, he's someone who's represented all the sort of the trilogy of the pillars of the sports industry, and is calling it absolutely right. And even whether he's naming the right or the wrong sports is irrelevant. Every sport right now needs to be looking right at themselves if they want to have a long and glorious future.
Yeah, I think he was very, very clear on that. But as I said about the iFollow incident and the EFL, and indeed my own history at the rights holder, there's no medals, and normally it's a P45 if you want to try and innovate and push things forward. So most people go for the easy option, because as Giles says, it's super comfortable. You know, it's a great job, a great expense account. You go to wonderful hotels. And then as Nathan said, British athletics finds the world change underneath their feet.
Well, look, a fascinating conversation. And Roger, I hope you did write that down, because the Psychos in Sport episode, I can't wait to do that.
Yeah. I want to come on that show. That is a cracker.
That is a cracker.
Yeah. I'll think about that immediately. Yep.
Well, we'll have to have Nathan back on as part of it, obviously. Well, gentlemen, that's it for another week. All that remains is to thank everybody for listening. Please, as always, do share the podcast with your friends, rate and review us on iTunes, and follow us on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainedR. You'll find me on Twitter at TTMYGH.
You'll find my...
Roger,
to be you.
Right. How many times have we finished with you saying, as in the lake?
Yeah, I'm sorry, guys. I was thinking about something. I wanted to do a plug for the captain's table, and I just lost my concentration.
Go on then, I'll do it
after you, Giles. On you go.
Okay, you can find me on Twitter at GilesMorgan71.
And of course, you can find me at the usual place, RPM Como, as in the lake. But don't forget the captain's table every Monday. The list of guests, honestly, just knock your socks off. And Giles is just doing a fantastic job with getting people to open up in ways that you don't often hear or see. So,
well, I'm glad to announce we've got Mark Pugach coming up, and then we've also got Brian O'Driscoll to name, and Thomas Bjorn, former Ryder Cup captain. Those are all confirmed and coming your way.
Well, I'm far more interested in the value of the photographs locked away in Giles' safe, because he is coming up with some extraordinary guests. But that's another subject for another day. Gentlemen, as always, thank you so much. And what do you say we do this again next week?
Thanks.
Beautiful.
Thanks. Wonderful.